Proceed to the second case of the morning. It's Scott Southworth versus the Board of Regents, University of Wisconsin. Mr. Balistrieri.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Balistrieri. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, and I'm representing the Defendant Appellant Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System. This is the third time this case has been before this court. The first two times, of course, it was here on the merits. This time the question involves attorney fees. And the question is, were the plaintiffs, in this case the remaining plaintiffs, Southworth and Thompson, the prevailing parties in this case, so as to be entitled to an award of attorney's fees? Our contention is that they were not the prevailing party, and furthermore, that they did not bring their motion for attorney fees within the time that had been prescribed by an order of the district court based on a stipulation of the parties, and that the district court should never have even considered their application for attorney fees. With respect to the question of the timely application for attorney fees, I would just like to try to bring the court to the point at which the stipulation for the time in which attorney fees could be applied for was entered into by the parties. We had been in this case, we had been in the district court, we had been in this court, we had been to the United States Supreme Court. In the United States Supreme Court, the university obtained a ruling that at least put it this way, that it was constitutional to establish a system whereby the university could require all students to put money into this student fee system, and that the university could then use those student fees to fund organizations which engaged in expressive activity. So we had already won. The university had already won the big battle. They had been told by the United States Supreme Court that a student fee system was okay. After that, we went back to the district court on the question involving the parameters of the student fee system. What was required in order to ensure the viewpoint neutrality that the United States Supreme Court had said was the hallmark of a constitutional student fee system? So that was the only question remaining in the district court. Now, we lost in the district court.
Mr. Balistrieri, forgive me for interrupting you, but I have a kind of bottom line question, and I guess I'm going to ask it of you, and I'd be interested in what Mr. Lorenz has to say as well, because it seems to me that in this case, both the parties and the district court seem to have used the wrong starting point as the basis for the comparison. There's a lot of discussion regarding what the plaintiffs have accomplished through the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court's opinion, or not accomplished through the Supreme Court's opinion. It seems to me that's irrelevant. The issue, I would think, is what the plaintiffs accomplished the second time around. In other words, after the remand.
Well, our purpose, or our argument here, is that they accomplished nothing at any point in this litigation, either the first time around going up to the Supreme Court or the second time around after it was remanded from the Supreme Court. So that's what we've tried to do. That's what I've tried to do, is to take the court through the various steps of this litigation and try to show the court that at no point did the plaintiffs come away with a surviving judgment in which they prevailed, in which they gained anything of immediate practical value to them. And I agree with you that probably the most important aspect of that is what happened the second time around in this court.
Well, it seems that part of your reasoning that they didn't achieve anything is because the university did a lot of things on its own initiative.
And
reconstructed and did a great deal with this to achieve viewpoint neutrality and unbridled discretion and all that stuff. That we went in great pains the last opinion
yes.
to try to go through and describe meticulously and go through it. And it's a very complicated system, but it's at least defined, I guess, as sufficiently bridled to ensure viewpoint neutrality. But I guess the question is whether this was influenced by all of this litigation or whether this is something you just done anyway.
Well, first of all, whether it was influenced by the litigation is now irrelevant after the United States Supreme Court's decision in the Buchanan case that says that just because a result is influenced by litigation doesn't make.
So it's not written out in the opinion. It's something that they did. What is the word they use in the opinion in that case? There's a word that describes.
Yeah, and I don't recall.
Whatever it is, you wrote it down.
I would use the word gratuitous.
All right. Well, whatever it wasn't that, but anyway, that it's a reaction or in anticipation. What is it?
Catalyst.
Mr. Lawrence
is correct.
Catalyst.
Yes.
All right. It's the catalyst.
Catalyst
impact,
yeah.
And so the catalyst effect. They say, well, you can't credit that to one side or the other.
But we would go even beyond that. I mean, we're not resting here on an argument that a lot of what the university did was gratuitous, and that this case was no more than a catalyst for what the university did. Our argument goes beyond that, and it is that even assuming that what the university did to ensure viewpoint neutrality by establishing these guidelines and by establishing an appeal system, even if that had been mandated by an order of the court, the plaintiffs have not achieved any practical benefit as a result of that.
You've argued that the decision did not necessitate any actual change in the university's behavior, right?
In terms of the fundamental workings of the system.
But you don't deny that you changed, that it changed.
There were some changes.
The referendum procedure.
Yes, there were some changes that the university made. All right, you said it's the referendum procedure. The university did that without any judgment requiring them to abandon the referendum procedure. When this case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court cast some doubt on the validity of the referendum procedure, but it didn't hold the referendum procedure unconstitutional. When this case got remanded, the university voluntarily abandoned that. The referendum procedure. There was never any judgment saying that the referendum procedure was unconstitutional.
Does the plaintiff obtain a benefit when a court tells a defendant not to do something it wasn't doing anyway?
Our answer is no.
Of course, they have the benefit of knowing that the defendant won't engage in that kind of behavior in the future, doesn't it?
Yeah, but basically the university didn't do that in the past.
Yeah.
When was the referendum, for example, that they changed? I have to say I don't remember all the details of this. It's been a while, but I thought that wasn't in the record.
That they abandoned the referendum?
That, yeah. Maybe it was.
Yeah, that is in the record.
Okay. Right. What was not in the record?
What is not in the record was the travel grant.
Oh, that's right.
Business.
Okay. That I know we did.
You had ruled that the university could not give any travel grants, because at the time that you came down with your decision, the record that was before the court showed that the university had not established any guidelines for travel grants. But in fact, while this case was pending in this court, they did establish guidelines for travel grants, which were in effect at the time of the decision of this court, even though the record before this court didn't reflect that.
Okay. I there's a lot of... One of the things that, as you show in the case, and you describe in your briefs and everything, this is a very complicated process. Anyone who challenges it you better really know what they're trying to do. I'm not sure whether that's by design or what, but nevertheless, it does appear with all the various appeals and the checks and balances and the criteria one has to go through to avoid viewpoint bias, I guess. It has to be viewpoint neutral. Now, in your brief, you pretty much recite, say, hey, this they had it better before than they do now. And that sort of confused me. I wasn't exactly sure what it was they could do before that they can't do now. Someone who doesn't like the funding.
At least before there was a requirement of viewpoint neutrality, what they could do is go to the student government, which gives most of these grants.
They meaning people who didn't like
people
the
who didn't, people who didn't like the grant. The plaintiffs, Southworth and Thompson.
Yeah, you have somewhere in your brief, you have a long list of those they didn't like, and you, I guess, pretty
and a long list
openly
of
say, hey, guess what, we did exactly the same thing.
And a long list of those that are still being funded.
Yeah.
The thing is that before the viewpoint neutrality requirement was imposed by the U.S. Supreme Court, students like Southworth and Thompson, who didn't like the idea of the university funding organizations like, let's say, Wisberg, could go to the meeting of the university government at which the funding decisions were made, and they could try to convince the student government not to fund Wisberg on the ground that Wisberg's viewpoint did not represent a viewpoint of the majority of the students on the campus. Now they can't do that because of the requirement of viewpoint neutrality. They
well, didn't do any good anyway.
It didn't do any good anyway, but at least...
I guess what... Yeah, you can go and wave your arms around. They say, yeah.
At least they could wave their arms. Now their arms are shackled.
Well, that's what I hope that isn't the case, based on everything that we reviewed the last time, is that there are these checks and balances and this kind of thing. And one of the things that was pretty much set out is that based on prior giving, because that was and length of time that an organization, the CSO, exists, that is not a valid criteria for determining funding. Now, maybe when Wisberg, they get a huge amount of money, isn't it, $50,000 or $60,000?
They get a large amount of money. It varies year to year.
I mean, it's the lion's share. And then there's a long list of others that get some. And I assume there's a long list, I hope, of people that members of these organizations would object to. I don't know. I really don't know what other organizations are being funded.
There is a mind-boggling variety of organizations that get funded through this.
Yeah. So we would hope that it is balanced and that everyone has an opportunity to have their viewpoint heard and minorities aren't excluded and all that. That's at least the way we tried to look at it the last time. But to say that nothing was changed or nothing was impacted, that's the question. We haven't really talked much about this deadline other than there was a stipulation, because I'm just wondering to what extent there's any discretionary thing, and the court that signed it, whether he determined what it meant and that sort of thing, because that would be obviously dispositive if we say doesn't matter, too late. But you know, we spend a lot of time on these others, which I realize they're both before us.
Well, I would just before we get to the question of the time, actually, I see my white light is on. My yellow light is on.
Yeah, sorry.
That's all right. I would just like to emphasize the fact that regardless of what the plaintiffs may have obtained or how they may have obtained it in terms of the way that the university administers the student fee system, you know, and I've had some contact with this in a context of another case outside of this case. And I can assure the court that this is, in fact, being administered in a viewpoint-neutral fashion. Sometimes, maybe even to the point of absurdity, that it is being administered in a viewpoint-neutral fashion. But it is being administered that way. But the bottom line here is, you look at what the plaintiffs wanted in this action, and that was to stop the university from using their money to fund these organizations. And they haven't achieved any success at all in doing that. They are still required to pay 100% of the student fees, and any and all of their money is still going to organizations to which they object.
How much is that student fee now?
Sorry?
How much is the student fee? Do you know offhand?
It just went up, and I don't recall exactly.
For sure that.
It's something like $350, $400, somewhere in.
Okay.
And that. You did ask me a question. I see my red light is on.
Yeah, I'm going to give you another minute or so afterward, but we kind of dragged this on. But
okay. And I will just very briefly respond. I understand what the standard of review is on the initial question of the timing. I understand that we have a difficult burden of proof, but I think in this case that Judge Shabazz really did erroneously exercise his discretion, because basically what he did on the timing, and you have to keep in mind that the time limits were established on the basis of the stipulation of the parties. Basically, he just threw that stipulation out the window for the reason that he just thought that a different stipulation would have been better. That it would have been better if the parties had stipulated that they didn't have to apply for fees until after the time for applying for a United States certiorari had expired. Now, maybe it would have been better. I don't know. I don't think it would have under the circumstances of this case. But even if that were true, just because a different time limit might have been better is no ground for just throwing out the stipulation of the parties to a time limit that wasn't in and of itself unrealistic or absurd.
Okay.
So, I thank you for your attention.
All right, thanks. July?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jordan Lawrence representing the students. Several things that I'd like to address here. First, on the matter of the time limit. Although these were based on stipulations, these were both signed orders by Judge Shabazz. The second one did not cancel out the first one. Judge Shabazz was faced with the situation of reconciling and harmonizing disparate language, and he came to the conclusion that he did, which I think is correct and accurate, that the parties stipulated to put everything off to the end of the litigation to deal with attorney's fees, and that should be judged by the abuse of discretion standard.
The judge has very broad discretion to decide whether to hold the party to a stipulation, does he not?
Yes, yes. And there were two stipulations, and so that he was faced with having to harmonize them. And I think he did it in an accurate way, rather than having to consider a fee application while at the time either party could have still been able to appeal to the Supreme Court. We were awarded half of what we asked for, and although I do not have the exact breakdown of hours, approximately half of the hours were generated after the Supreme Court's appeal. And one of the reasons was we had an actual trial on remand, which we did not have. Everything was done on summary judgment, and as you know, and so that's one concern. Although I don't think that was factoring in the judge's thinking, I do want to note that is the net effect of what he did.
See, I was concerned because your brief begins with comparison of the state of affairs before Southworth litigation and after.
Yes.
And many of the changes that you articulate arose as a direct or an indirect result of the Supreme Court's decision. And, you know, I wondered, of course, and the brief certainly made it seem as if you were seeking the fees for time spent up to the Supreme Court decision. But now you're saying that isn't so?
Well, I would say this. I would say I think we are entitled to fees from day one, which I can articulate. But even if the dispute is no, it's not until you did the amended complaint after the Supreme Court remand. I think the fee award is justified because in number of hours, it's basically the what we got was for the time after the remand. Now, we did win specific things that after remand to change the universities. And the reason why we went back to the beginning was that there were absolutely no safeguards built in procedurally. That, for example, when this court in its August 1998 decision pointed out how there was extensive lobbying by the homosexual groups to defund a Christian group on campus, and there were no safeguards built in. So when that group was defunded, we can't tell why it was defunded.
Mr. Lawrence, I'm going to try and pin you down here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Shouldn't we only be looking at the state of affairs after the Supreme Court decision and comparing it with the state of affairs after this court's decision of October 2002?
Yes, but what I'm saying practically doesn't, there's no practical difference between what you're saying and I'm saying for this reason, is that none of the changes procedurally were put in by the university until after the Supreme Court remand. They were put in response to the December 2000 district court injunction that said, because when we had the trial after the Supreme Court, what was in effect was the policies that were in effect from day one when we filed back in 1996, that there had been no new policies adopted, there had been nothing that the university had changed, because we kept staying all the district court order, this court's order. So when the Supreme Court ruled, it was on the system that was on day one, and we went back to remand. The only thing that had changed was their abandonment of the referendum system in response to the Supreme Court's decision, and the getting rid of the policy that said no political or religious groups could be funded. All the procedural things that they are claiming that they never violated were not instituted until February of 2001.
Look, despite any spin, the plaintiffs lost in the Supreme Court. Okay? They wanted to be exempt from paying mandatory fees to certain organizations, and the court held that they must pay. The Supreme Court held that both parties should bear their own costs, right?
Well, I think...
Am I shocking you?
I think it's incomplete in what you're saying. There was a remand that this court found was a remand on all the issues. We lost on our legal theory that viewpoint neutral distribution made no difference of whether there's compelled payment. But the Supreme Court, if you read the opinion, the dissenting decision disguised as a concurring opinion that Justice Souter wrote, he wanted us to lose the way that you're stating it. But there was a benevolent remand to give us another chance to relitigate it under a theory to prove whether the distributions had been viewpoint neutral or not. And this court said that all of the things, the procedural safeguards that the university was forced to put into place by the district court's injunction had to remain in effect, or else they wouldn't be meeting the Supreme Court's requirement. None of those things were put in by the university except for the repealing of the referendum thing, because they could hear the footsteps of the Supreme Court. And then, plus some of the criteria they had, were declared unconstitutional. Now, this gets us to the matter of the escrowed money that the university still has not paid us back. The travel grants and the GSSF grants under this court's ruling were distributed under unconstitutional criteria. And we're still waiting for the check of the refund of the money that the students had to pay. Now, this was damages in the sense that we knew that the appeal was coming, the students would still be enrolled, would have to pay the fee. The stipulation was that the university would keep the money and pay it back if this court said that any of the criteria had been unconstitutional, which this court did. So we're entitled to some compensatory damages, which the university, so there is direct change in the legal relationship and benefit that we have received, as well as the changes that the university was forced to put in by the district court's opinion. These were not things that the district court or that the college was the university was doing before this. Specifically, the procedures on written criteria to giving out the opinion, giving out the grants. When there's a turn down, they had to write out what criteria they had violated. There was an appeal process which didn't exist before that they were forced to institute, as well as I would say under Buchanan they got rid of the referendum, according to the university president, because of the Supreme Court's decision. Now, there wasn't an order from the Supreme Court that said get rid of the referendum, but the university, in this stipulation that has been at issue on the timing, there's an attached letter to it in the file from the chancellor of the university saying we're changing this because of what the Supreme Court said.
Mr. Lorenz, your brief states that we should review the award of fees under the abuse of discretion standard.
Yes.
Suppose, however, that the district court misapplied the FARR test, for example, by comparing the judgment recovered with the recovery sought in the first round of litigation rather than the second. Would that be a legal error that we could review de novo?
I think in the abstract it possibly could be, but that's not the grounds that he did it. That the two things that he references as to why we're entitled to fees was the procedural safeguards for giving out the awards and the appeal process, which were not in effect after the Supreme Court appeal. So that the university cannot claim, and it is an inaccurate assessment of the facts, that the university had all these procedural safeguards in before we filed the suit or while we were at the Supreme Court or somewhere in between. These were the basis of the attorney's fee award, and they did not come into effect until after the December 2000 district court opinion. And the Supreme Court's decision was in March of 2000. So the university, it was totally naked when it came to procedural safeguards all through the litigation, through the Supreme Court, and up through the trial that we had in December of 2000.
Let me go back again. Once the plaintiffs amended their claim to allege that the university was not administering the fees program in a viewpoint-neutral manner, will you agree that the scale had been reset and the comparison between recovery sought and judgment recovered had to begin anew?
I don't know if I'm going to convince the court of this, but I think it starts from the beginning for this reason. The university from day one...
Yeah, I finally got an answer from you.
Well, I hope these others have been helpful. We have won, Your Honor, specific relief after the Supreme Court remand. That I want this court to be clear of that none of the procedural things that was upheld by this court in October in 2002 existed after the Supreme Court remand. They were only instituted because of the district court's injunction. So that did materially change, as well as this escrowed money. Now, the issue of whether viewpoint neutrality distribution of the money therefore allowed a compelled contribution was something that the university argued to this court in the August 1998 decision. So I think from day one, this issue of viewpoint neutrality has always been before it. The district court rejected it, this court rejected it, the Supreme Court reversed and said, no, we think it is the key factor. So then we had to go back down. Now, even if this court says, well, we think the clock and the meter starts running after the remand, the fee award reflects basically what we expended after the Supreme Court remand. But I think we're entitled to, I mean, we didn't get everything we asked for. We only got 50% of it. We are entitled to a partial award, and I think that what this judge did was appropriate. To send it back to the district court to re-examine this, I think, you don't want us coming back here. It'll be the fifth time. This is the fourth time to come back and visit you again for the fifth time on this matter.
You know, we can always ask that oral argument be waived. If you don't want to waive it, we can waive it for you.
So. But I think we are that the judge did not either abuse his discretion or using de novo standard of review in any way. This should be overturned, that this is a reasonable award that should be allowed to stand in light of the partial win that we got at the district court and at this court after the appeal. And we're still waiting for the university to pay back the escrowed money directly to the student plaintiffs, which is a direct, concrete benefit that we are entitled to in light of this court's decision.
How much is that about?
I'm not sure of the exact amount, but I think that it's probably $50 or less per student, something like that. But these are not, I would point out, nominal damages. These are actual damages because that's the amount that they're forced to pay. You heard the comment about the $350. There's a lot of other fee money they're required to pay that has never been in dispute. The amount of disputed money is much less than the $350. Like they pay for the health service and things like that, that have never been at issue in this case. If there are no further questions, we urge this court to affirm the decision of the district court on the attorney fee claim. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Ballesteri, I'll give you a minute because we talked a lot here, but I think you may have covered it at the end, so maybe we don't need to go into that.
Well, I think I've covered everything, except I do want to make one point in response to Mr. Lawrence's argument about the escrow money. The escrow money was to be paid in the event was to be paid back in the event that a court found that the university had been distributing funds in a viewpoint discriminatory fashion, and no court has ever found that because no evidence has ever been introduced that the university was doing that.
The travel money or whatever it was.
Well,
I don't know. I know it's not a lot of money.
It's not a lot of money, and there's no evidence that anything was ever distributed under the criteria that this court found unconstitutional. So there is absolutely no evidence to support us giving.
Didn't the court find that the travel grant program didn't have enough specific criteria?
It didn't have any criteria.
Against viewpoint-based decisions?
It didn't have any criteria at the time it was before this court. Although the university did, in fact, adopt criteria, and those criteria were, in fact, in effect at the time this court rendered its decision. It's just that it was not part of the record before this court.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
In case we take them under advisement.